As long as one is materially inclined or desirous of merging into the spiritual effulgence, one cannot enter into the realm of pure devotional service. So careful analysis of these verses will reveal a variety of reasons why pure bhakti or pure devotional service surpasses mukti or liberation. And it will inspire the devotee to reject all desires for bhakti and mukti. So here, there's an entry here from this Nectar Devotion. Prabhupada's mentioning. There's a prayer by Prita Maharaj. My dear Lord, if after accepting liberation, I have no chance of hearing the glories of your Lordship, chanted by pure devotees from the core of their hearts, in praise of your lotus feet, and if I have no chance to taste this honey of transcendental bliss, then I shall never ask for liberation, or the so-called spiritual emancipation. I shall simply always pray unto your Lordship that you may give me millions of tongues and millions of ears, so that I can constantly chant and hear your transcendental glories. So this is a great personality from the Bhagavatam. King Prithu, he lived millions of years ago, and he was the ruler of the earth planet. So he's giving some indication. He wants millions of tongues and ears. Two ears and one tongue is not enough. And what does he want to do with all those tongues and ears? He wants to constantly hear and chant about the glories and the wonder and the praises of the Supreme Lord. So then there's a prayer also by Bharat Maharaj. And in his prayer we can see how Uttama Bhakti is one who has this pure bhakti. He can give up all material comforts. So, because usually people want material comforts, nice home, nice clothes, tasty foods. But King Bharata, he was the king of the world at one time. He was the emperor of the world, King Bharata. There's a book called Mahabharata, the history of greater India, of the whole world. There's one time the world was called Varsh. Varsha means land. So he was 24 years old. 24 is quite young. The senses are very strong. The body is very healthy and strong. Right? And he had a queen, and he had so many children and palaces and gold and wealth. He was a king. A very powerful king. And he left everything. He walked away from everything because he had so much attraction to wanting to dedicate his entire life to serving God. The great King Bharata was so much attached to serving the feet of Krishna that he gave up the lordship over the earth planet and his affection for children, society, friends, royal opulence, and beautiful wife. He was so lucky that goddess of fortune, Lakshmi Devi, was pleased with him and ready to offer him all kinds of material concessions. But he never accepted any of these material comforts. And then, so Bharat Maharaj is showing that if one is actually serving the Lord in devotion, serving Krishna with bhakti or devotion, then he can give up all material comforts. It doesn't matter. Then there's a prayer by Lord Shiva, and he shows that the devotee is completely disinterested in heaven or hell. He simply desires to serve the Lord. And his prayer is there on page 37, 38. He says, my dear Sati, that's his wife, Parvati, persons who are devoted to Narayan, or Krishna, are not afraid of anything. If they are elevated to higher planetary systems, or if they get liberation from material contamination, or if they're pushed down to the hellish condition of life, any situation, they're not afraid of anything, simply because they have taken shelter of the lotus feet of Narayan. For them, any position in the material world is as good as another. So that this shows that Lord Shiva is saying, they don't care about liberation, They don't even care if they go to hell. They're not afraid because they've taken shelter of Lord Narayan. You see, in Prahlad Maharaj, Prahlad was a 5-year-old boy. He was a prince, and his father was an atheist, a very staunch atheist. And his son, the Prince Prahlad, he was a great Vaishnava devotee, a very pious religious boy. And so his father became envious of him, and he wanted to kill him in so many ways. But Prahlad Maharaj was never afraid. He was always chanting and always remembering the Lord. He didn't have any fear. His father threw him off a cliff. His father threw him under the feet of an elephant. He threw him in a pit of poisonous snakes. He tried to pierce him with daggers and swords and lances. And he never showed any signs of fear. He was completely fearless because he was totally surrendered to Krishna. He said, Rake Krishna Mare Ke, Mare Krishna Rake Ke. If Krishna wants to protect me, no one can kill me. And if Krishna wants to kill me, then no one can protect me. So this is fearlessness. So there's, as we mentioned the other day, there's 28 verses in this chapter discussing all about how devotional service surpasses the liberation. And there's a famous verse in the first canto of Bhagavatam, chapter 7, verse 10. It's called the Atmaram verse. And that also shows that one who is fixed in devotion, then he's free from all interest in gyan and karma. There's an interesting point here, actually, on page 45, Prabhupada's purport, because sometimes people ask this, chapter 4. Sometimes people say, well, if you go to Vaikuntha, if you become elevated and you enter Vaikuntha, the spiritual world, can you go from there to Goloka or to Vrajagokul? Can you elevate yourself, go beyond that? And so there's different ideas, but Prabhupada says here that some of the liberated persons who have achieved these four stages of liberation may also develop affection for Krishna and be promoted to the Goloka Vrindavan planet in the spiritual sky. In other words, those who are already promoted to the Vaikuntha planets and who possess four kinds of liberation may also sometimes develop affection for Krishna and become promoted to Krishna Loka. It's very interesting. In other words, some jivas, some living entities, they enter the spiritual world. They attain Salokya Mukti or Sarupya Mukti or Sharsti Mukti or Samipya Mukti. They attain the same forearm form as Vishnu, and a beautiful blue body with four arms and lotus petal eyes and long hair and very beautiful attractive forms. And that's called Sarupya. That is the form of Vishnu. And they're living there. But somehow they see paintings of Krishna, or they hear stories of Krishna, and they become attracted to Krishna, even in Vaikuntha. And then they practice some kind of Krishna bhajan, Krishna bhakti. And they develop love for Krishna. And they can actually be promoted from Vaikuntha to Krishna Loka. Very interesting stage. This you don't hear very often, such a thing. So, because people say, well, can you change your rasa? Or can you elevate yourself from Vaikuntha to Goloka? Prabhupada is saying that there's four kinds of liberation, Vaishnava liberation, which we're not... Those that are engaged in bhakti are not really concerned. Whether it's Salokya liberation and Sarupya and Sharsti and Samipya means to live in association with the Lord, Samipya. Sharsti is to have a palace like the Lord, big palace, and so many servants have equal opulence. Sarupya is to have the same form, except no Kostuba and no Srivats. And Sarupya. And Salokya is to live on the same planet. So these are all Vaishnava liberations. They are all received at the platform of pure devotion, Shantaras or Dasiras. One has attained prema, and he goes there. Now, listen to this. Some of these liberated persons may also develop affection for Krishna and be promoted to the Goloka Vrindavan planet in a spiritual sky. And beyond Vaikuntha. In other words, people often ask the question, well, do people ever change their rasa? Because in Vaikuntha, the only rasas are Shanta and Dasya, basically. Even the so-called Madhurya or conjugal love of Lakshmi is basically Dasya. She says massaging his feet most of the time. It's very much Aishwarya Mayi Bhakti, filled with Aishwarya. In other words, those who are already promoted to Vaikuntha planets and who possess the four kinds of liberation may sometimes develop affection for Krishna and become promoted to Krishna Loka. That means you have to change your rasa, because in Goloka and Braja, Krishna Loka, the main rasa, there's basically three rasas: Sakya, Vatsalya, and Madhurya. Parakya and Swakya. Dwarka is Swakya and Vrindavan is Parakya. So this is very interesting. That means you can not only change from, go from Vaikuntha to Krishna Loka, but you can change rasa also. Although it's nitya, it's stahibhav. It's your nitya siddhabhava, as we mentioned the other day. It can change. How it changes, I can't say. Somebody stops over there, Narada Muni visits Vaikuntha, and he's glorifying Narayan, and he starts singing Radha Sahasranam. Because this whole chapter is about how devotional service, you know, surpasses liberation. This chapter is all about glorifying devotional service, that it surpasses liberation and all these other things. So, there's one verse, verse 58 of this chapter, says, Tatrapyekantinam shesta govinda ritamanasa yesham shrisha prasadopi manohartam nashaknuyat. Of all the one-pointed devotees of the different avatars, devotees whose hearts have been stolen by Govinda are the highest, because even the mercy of the Lord of Lakshmi, which is Krishna or Narayan, can not steal their minds. So, this is how powerful Govinda Bhakti is. If we're performing service to try to please Govinda, Krishna, Krishna Govinda, and it says there's no higher person, Shrestha, Ekantinam. He alone, Eka means one, he alone is the most fortunate person, because Rita Manasa, his mind, Mana, Man, and Rita has been stolen. Rita Manasa means stolen by Govinda. So even if Narayan comes before the devotee, he does not feel attracted. And there's a classic story, Bhagavatam. Actually, the story is in Chaitanya Charitamrita. Krishna was once having rasa dance in Paita, which is in the rasa stali at Govardhan. And he was, somehow or other, he wanted to go away with Radharani. So Krishna went with Radharani. And when he was taking Radharani, they were moving here and there in the forest. And then they heard that all the gopis were coming. So then Krishna left Radharani and went Nikunj. He said, you stay here secretly, and I will mislead the gopis. So then Krishna played a joke on the gopis. He went a little bit of distance, leaving Radharani in that Nikunj, solitary Nikunj. And then the gopis were coming. Then Krishna manifested four arms. He showed four arms, like Narayan, with Gada, Shank, Padma, Chakra, and his four arms. And then the gopis came, and they said, oh, Narayan, the Mo Narayan. They showed some little respect, but they were not very interested in worshipping him or showing much care for him. They said, Narayan, have you seen Krishna? So this shows that although they were that Narayan is God, he's the personality of Godhead, the gopis of Braj, the Braja gopis, the damsel of the Braj, they were not the least bit attracted or caring for Narayan. And then then Lalita came, and Vishakha came. And they're very near and dear to Krishna's heart, frantically like Radharani. So when they came in front of Krishna, then Krishna, he could not maintain his disguise anymore as Vishnu. Then his two arms disappeared, and he took out his flute and started playing his flute. So this small pastime shows that the Braja Gopis, they're not attractive because their minds and hearts, Govinda, Shrestha Govinda Rita Manasa, their minds and hearts have been stolen by the beauty of Govinda. So that's why devotees, if someone offers us liberation, or if someone offers us bhukti or sense gratification, oh, you give up Krishna, you give up chanting Hare Krishna, I'll give you $1 million, I'll give you liberation. Then the devotee says, I don't want it. I don't want liberation. I don't want $1 million or $10 million. I have Krishna's service. What more do I need? I'm happy with that. So this is proof that when the mind and heart are stolen by the beauty and sweetness of Govinda, then there's nothing in this world or even in the other world of a spiritual liberation that could attract the devotee. The devotees reject all forms of mukti, liberation. Because they're enjoying the supreme bliss in the service of Krishna. So the question is raised, how is the bliss derived from serving Krishna, which is called Rasananda or Sevananda? How is it superior to Brahmananda, the bliss of merging in divine Brahman? This is actually a very interesting section here. Describes, we hear oftentimes in the scriptures that Krishna consciousness or the happiness of serving Krishna is far exceeds Brahmananda, the happiness of Brahmananda, the happiness of merging in Brahman. But we don't really have a way of understanding, of comparing that or understanding that. What is Brahmananda? So here there's some discussion. To understand something about Brahmananda. So when devotees are serving the Lord, they're trying to please the Lord by hearing and chanting, remember Him. There are different degrees of ananda or bliss in different spheres. The first and lowest type of happiness or bliss is called Manushyananda. So this is Manush. Manush means man, all right, human being. So the first, the lowest level of ananda, because we're going to go all the way up to Brahmananda. So it starts off with Manushyananda. Manushyananda. A young man or young person who is moral in character, he has read and studied the Vedas, he's active in karma, he's strongly built in body and strong in physical strength, who has the whole world under his control. Such a youth enjoys the highest pleasures in many different ways in this world. Such type of ananda or pleasure is called Manushyananda. Now, hundreds of times this, if you multiply this Manushyananda hundreds of times, this Manushyananda means human pleasures, the pleasures of this world that we attain from our body. So if you multiply this 100 times, then you get Gandharvananda. Now he describes what is Gandharvananda. A man who's a Kshatriya by birth and who by dint of specific Vedic karma has attained to the stage of a Gandharva. And he defines that, a sort of demigod in heaven and a heavenly musician. He is eligible to enjoy Gandharvananda, which is hundreds of times that of Manushyananda or earthly pastime. So, in other words, a Kshatriya, he can elevate himself to this Gandharva platform. Now he's saying, but when a Brahmana, who is well-read in the Vedas, and is conversant with Brahman, the Absolute, and who by birth is a Gandharva, he can attain to the status of a Deva Gandharva, and then enjoy Deva Gandharvananda. which is hundreds of times more than Manusha Gandharvananda. Such a brahmana must have renounced all worldly pleasures. Hundreds of times more than Deva Gandharva Ananda is Chiraloka Ananda, which is also called Pitriloka Ananda. This is described. A brahmana who is established in Brahman and who has given up all mundane desires is entitled to this Pitriloka Ananda. Multiply this by 100 times more, then you get Ajanaja Devaloka Ananda. The Ajanaja gods enjoy this bliss. The Ananda of Karma Devas is 100 times more than that of Ajana Devas. That is called Karma Devananda. It's really funny progression. The Brahmanas who have attained heaven by performing the Agnihotra Vedic rites are called Karma Devas. Hundreds of times more pleasure are the Devanandas. This means the Devas, demigods, they enjoy hundreds of times more pleasure than the Karma Devas. These Devas are the 8 Vasus, the 11 Rudras, the 12 Adityas, Indra and the Prajapati. These are the 33 Devas that enjoy the Devananda. Indra is the king of all the gods, and Brihaspati is their guru or spiritual guide. Hundreds of times more than Devananda, pleasures of the gods, is Indrananda, pleasures enjoyed by Indra. Brihaspati's Ananda is again 100 times the pleasures that are available in Indrananda. Prajapati's Ananda is 100 times more than that of Brihaspati. And Brahmananda is 100 times more than this Prajapati Ananda. Thus, it is almost impossible to assess and measure the depth and limit of Brahmananda. It is for this reason that the Upanishads have said that man's mind and words fail to describe the exact nature of Brahmananda. This is why Rupa Goswami and our Acharyas, when they're talking about the Anand, Sevanand, or the Bhakti Anand, or the bliss of serving Krishna, pure devotional service, it is like an ocean of Ananda compared to a drop of the happiness that's available in Brahmananda. So this progression gives us some idea of the incredible extent of happiness that must be available in Brahmananda. And that, compared to the sukh or the happiness of bhakti, that is only a drop. So when we will enter that ocean of devotional Ananda, that's another thing. But I thought this was I've never seen such a description of this gradation of Ananda before, so we thought we would. Nectar of Devotion, Chapter 5. Purity of Devotion. There's some nice verses here from Rupa Goswami describing the purity of devotional service. He says, the execution and perfection of devotional service, which means bhakti, is not dependent on any material consideration. In other words, jnana yoga or ashtanga yoga or meditation or sacrifices or yagya, they all depend on so many factors. The purity of place, purity of chant, of mantra chanting, purity of body, purity of mind. Many things are required to attain perfection in these other paths of self-realization. But bhakti has no limitation. It's always pure, no matter where or how or however you apply bhakti or practice bhakti. He says that only bhakti yoga is completely pure in the sense that it is free from dependence on external prerequisites. That's why the chapter is called the purity of devotional service. It's not, it's, by nature it's pure, it doesn't depend on other elements. Just like in meditation or chanting mantras, if you don't purely chant the mantra, you won't get any result. Hare Krishna mantra, no matter how you chant the mantra, you'll get some result, you'll get benefit. Of course, the more purely we chant, the more perfectly we chant the holy name, the quicker we get results, and the higher class results we get. If we chant the holy name of Krishna, Hare Krishna mantra, and we have wrong ideas, or we have misconceptions or ignorance, or we chant with anarthas, unwanted things in our heart, or we make offenses while chanting, we insult the Lord or insult His devotees, or belittle them, or belittle the scriptures, or find fault with the scriptures. These are called aparads, or offense. They are aparadha. They are against Radha. They are against the process of worship. So then we don't get such a high-class result of pure devotional service by such incorrect chanting. We get some benefit. We derive or we receive some material blessings or some material facility. Because the holy name is like a touchstone. It has power. Just like electricity, it can give you 5 watts of light or 10 watts, depending on the bulb. The holy name can give full illumination, like 500 watts or 1,000 watts, or it can give partial illumination. It depends on the chanter, the quality of his mind and heart, the quality of his faith, and the purity of his practice. So now we can talk about, there's different aspects in relation to purity. So here's some of the discussions here in this chapter 5, Nectar of Devotion. Although generally considered a disqualification from the path of self-realization, low birth does not impede the execution of bhakti. If someone is born as a shudra, which means lower class laborer, who doesn't have so much intelligence or power of discrimination, but he's a hard worker, so it would be difficult for him to practice Gyan Yoga. He has to study Sanskrit and chant so many difficult mantras and fix his mind on the impersonal meditation. Because his mind and intelligence are weak, he won't have very much success over there. So even when one has low birth, or any type of birth, he's eligible to practice bhakti. In the first canto of Bhagavatam, chapter 2, verse 6, it explains that devotional service has no material cause, therefore it cannot be checked by any material circumstances. It is open for all, without any distinction, and it's a constitutional occupation of the living entities. This is on page 47 of this chapter 5. So Rupa Goswami gives several quotes in this chapter from Padma Puran, Skanda Puran, Hari Bhakti. By quoting Skanda Puran, Padma Puran, and other Puran, that one can attain perfection in bhakti. And this perfection is open to all people equally, regardless of their birth. Now under the category of purity. Although a major prerequisite for other process of self-realization, purity is not a factor in determining our eligibility to perform bhakti. Now, like Gyan Yoga or Ashtanga Yoga, you must have a pure asana, and your body must have bathed, wear a pure clean cloth, and you must purify all your thoughts so you can meditate on Om. And there's lots of purity required. But in bhakti yoga, you can be clean clothes or unclean clothes, or clean body or unclean body, or clean mind or unclean mind. You just begin the process of bhakti by chanting and hearing and chanting Krishna's name in any position, in any state, and automatically it takes effect. And it says, even if a devotee falls down from the standard of purity, he need not undergo any separate process of purification, which is called prayaschitta, such as karma gyan. He takes up devotional service immediately and he becomes reinstated. On the contrary, we become purified by practicing bhakti. So then, Rupa Goswami cites seven verses to clarify verse 64, which says it is the esoteric significance of Vaishnava. He says it is the esoteric significance. He quotes this phrase, Vaishnava Shastranam Rahasyam. So this is the secret of Vaishnava Shastras, is that a fallen devotee need not do any prayaschitta. So in karma, again, if you fall from the path of Gyan Yoga, then you have to do so much atonement, fasting and difficult tapasya to get forgiven for that fall down or that deviation. But in bhakti, if you fall down or leave the path or break the principles, there's no separate atonement. You simply start chanting again, following the principles strictly and chanting, and that's automatically you're rightly situated without any separate endeavor or separate practices. The only qualification for bhakti is to follow the laws given by the guru. There's no need for any other method of purification. So, he quotes a series of verses from Bhagavatam to show this principle about one who discharges devotional service. If one takes up bhakti yoga, he's free from all kinds of obligations and responsibilities to society and to other living entities, even to animals. He simply chants Hare Krishna and everything is adjusted. He doesn't have to do anything more. Sounds very easy. But generally we get deviated from so many things. Agya yevam gunan doshan maya dishtana pi swakan dharman sat santyajyat ya sarvan mam bhajat satchasattama. This is the 11th canto of Bhagavatam, chapter 5, verse 41. Uddhava Gita, Krishna tells Uddhava, he who has renounced the duties of his own station of life, in other words, he has given up all the duties and responsibilities of his varna or ashram, by believing that pure bhakti in Krishna is the only goal, and even knowing that I have advised the practice of such duties as a means of purification of the mind, is a bhakta or devotee of the high order. One commentator, Mukunda Das, says that one who even knowingly, fully well, that the performance of the duties of varna ashram, life, cleanses the mind and develops knowledge, and if he doesn't perform these deep duties, he goes to hell if he renounces these duties. So what's being said here, that each station of life, social and spiritual station, whether one is a brahmana or a warrior or politician or businessman or laborer, or whether one is a celibate student or married or retired or renounced, these are the four varnas and four ashrams. And he has so many duties he has to do. Brahmacharya is supposed to not think of women, not look at women, not talk to women, not plan to meet with them, not meet intimately with them, and not touch them or engage in sex relation with them. But he's celibate. He's supposed to live alone. So that's his rule. He can't violate that. Otherwise, he gets punished by higher authorities for disregarding the rule of his position. His position as a brahmachari, celibate monk. So here he's saying that if one gives up all those duties and becomes sheltered at Krishna's feet and absorbs himself only in serving Krishna, not that he gives up his duties and says, oh, I'm a Krishna devotee, so I don't have to be celibate anymore. That was a duty as a brahmachari. No, Krishna's devotees are also brahmacharis. But he's still celibate and follows the rules of celibacy. But his main concentration is simply to serve Krishna, which which automatically includes all those things like celibacy. And here he says, Prabhupada emphasizes the point. Don't hesitate. Consider that because you are giving up all other engagements, there will be some flaw in your life. Don't think like that. I will give you all protection. But Krishna is telling there's no need to worry, that he will protect everyone. Famous verse, 11th canto, 541. Devarshi bhutata ne nimpratinam akin karonayam richavrajan sarvatmana yasranam sam sharanyam katomukundam parivrittikartam. This is Karabhajana addressing King Nimi. He says, O King, one who renounces everything and takes complete shelter in Krishna as the only and supreme object of his life, such a person never becomes, he has no more debts, or he never becomes indebted to the demigods, the rishis, the created beings, to his ancestors, his relatives. He does not become indebted to any of them. So he doesn't owe anyone anything. He doesn't have to do anything for anyone, because he's fully sheltered and absorbed in the service of Krishna. So what's the conclusion? It's a very inspiring conclusion, because we can understand that bhakti yoga is totally independent and self-sufficient. No imperial impediment should discourage us from the path of surrender. So in this verse, which is also quoted here, 1866 from the Gita, Sarva dharman prityaja mame kam sharanam vraja aham tvam sarva pape vyo moksha yashamimasucha. Give up all your occupations and just become surrendered unto me. I will give you assurance that I shall give you protection from all sinful reaction. So, Jiva Goswami, he comments on this phrase in the verse, Sarva Papevyo. Krishna is saying, I'll take away all your pap. Pap means sin. So Jiva says it actually means that Krishna will remove all the obstacles to practicing bhakti. And when he says that I'll remove all your sins, it says that that refers to removing all the sins of this life and previous lives. Pop means sin. Sarva papevyo. Krishna's very kind. We just serve Krishna. He does everything, takes care of everything else. All our debts, all our responsibilities, and all the contaminations in our heart, the sins and bad desires, Krishna takes those away from our heart also. So these are describing different aspects of bhakti yoga. Now finally, this is chapter 6, where Rupa Goswami starts describing what are the different ways that you can practice bhakti yoga. So it's generally understood that there's 64 limbs of devotion, 64 prominent ways of serving Krishna or pleasing Krishna. They're called the devotional practices. And they're derived from a book. They're recorded originally in a book called Hari Bhakti Vilas. So now Rupa Goswami is going to describe exactly how we can engage our senses, the senses of our body, in some practical service to Krishna. Like some people, we say, oh, the goal of life is to love Krishna. And love means service. We should always serve Krishna throughout the day and night. So then people say, well, what do you mean by service? Government service or army service? What do you mean by serving Krishna? How do you serve God? So then he gives the explanation by describing 64 ways to serve God from the beginning until the end. So the first point he mentions, in Sanskrit it's called Guru Pad Ashraya, to take shelter of the lotus of the feet of a bona fide spiritual master. Because this is the most important item of bhakti, it's mentioned first. So it gets a primary position, a primary emphasis. Rupa Goswami says he lists this most crucial item first. This principle opens the doors to the other 63 items of sadhana, because the spiritual master is the one who actually teaches us about the significance and practice of each one. Tasmad gurum prapadyeta jignyasu shay uttamam shabde pare chanishnatam brahmanyupashra upasamashrayam. This is 11th canto of the Bhagavatam, describing how this material world is a waste of time. So Bhakti Sanda Saraswati gives a purport that only a person who has understood the futility of material sense gratification can approach a bona fide spiritual master. Thus, the first principle of devotion is to clearly understand, because it says Guru Padashraya, that this material world is a false shelter. It's not real shelter. Dreams, people, friends, relatives, wives, husbands, children. We think these are our shelters. These are infallible soldiers, that they will protect us. But we should understand that these so-called shelters are material, and as such, they're extremely limited. So this is why it says that we should take shelter of Guru. Because Guru's shelter will give us that vision, will give us that power to actually progress in spiritual life and ultimately attain the spiritual world. They're real shelter. There's false shelter and real shelter. Ashraya means shelter. So Durashraya. Durashraya means bad shelter. Not a very good shelter. So this is the first point of bhakti. It starts here. It starts with the guru. It's like music. If you want to become a master of music and theory and so many things, well, it starts with getting a music teacher. Get a music teacher, that's a good start. Then we'll see how much music theory and everything one can develop. So Vishnu Chakravarti, he gives some good commentaries on these points. He says that when one receives a mantra, when one has a guru, he receives diksha, mantra diksha, receives initiation into a sacred mantra. So it says that the guru's internal spiritual mood of service to Radha Giridhari, or Radha and Krishna, is conveyed or transferred to the disciple through the medium of a mantra. Everything is given in seed form within the mantra. At first, the disciple will not be able to understand, but by performing sadhana and bhajan under the guidance of Sri Gurudev, by meditating on the mantra given by him, gradually everything will be revealed. The mantra is a direct representation of Sri Gurudev. Haro rushte gurushtrata, karo rushte nakashchana, tasmat sarva pratyanena, gurum eva prasadayat. If someone makes the Lord unhappy, the spiritual master may give him protection. But if the spiritual master is displeased, there is no one to give him protection. Therefore, one should please Sri Gurudev by all endeavors of one's body, mind, and words. So, Vishnath goes on to explain the qualifications of Guru. One should approach him and submit himself to Sadguru with body, mind, and words. In other words, he quotes He quotes the Mundaka Upanishad, Tadvigyanartam Sagurum Evabhigachet Samitpani Shotriyam Brahmanishtam. In order to obtain direct realization of the Supreme Absolute Reality, which is known in Sanskrit as Bhagavat Tattva Vastu Vigyan, a knowledge concerning Prema Bhakti, or knowledge about Prema Bhakti, a person must approach a Sadguru who knows the Vedas and he understands the truth of Krishna. Then, taking offerings in one's hands, one should submit oneself to such a Sadguru with body, mind, and words. That's Ashraya, Guru Parashraya. Submit. Take shelter. So Jiva Goswami says that there's two kinds of instructors who disseminate knowledge of Bhagavat Tattva. One is called Saraga, without attachments, and Niraga, with attachments. Instructors who are greedy for wealth and remain desirous for sensual enjoyment are known as speakers with material attachments, or Saraga Vaktas. Interesting point. Talking about two kinds of teachers. Some teachers, they speak well, but they're very much attached to material enjoyment. So the influence of such instructors is not enduring. An instructor who is a topmost devotee of the Lord, Parama Bhagavad Bhakta, he's adept in relishing Bhakti Shastras, or Bhakti Ras, and evoking spiritual emotions in others, Saras, and who is capable of extracting the essence of anything, Saragrahi, is known as a speaker without attachments, or Niraga Vivakta. In examining this Guru Tattva, or the truth about Guru, Jiva Goswami cites three types of Guru: Shravan Guru, Shiksha Guru, and Diksha Guru. So the Shravan Guru, who is a Shravan Guru? That person from whom one hears knowledge of the Bhaktas, Bhakti, and Bhagavat Tattva is known as Shravan Guru. Sadhaka should receive instructions on Bhagavad Dharma from such a spiritual master. By carrying out those instructions, Hari will personally gives himself to the devotee. So the Shravan Guru, he is the one who gives instructions how to execute bhajan. There may be many Shravan Gurus. The sadhaka should take shelter of one Mahapurush among them who is suitable to his nature and receive instructions regarding how to perform bhajan. Suitable to his nature means that when you meet with that sadhu, he's friendly, he's affectionate. So that then we can relate to him. If he's very proud or very elevated or very distant from everyone, then it's very hard to relate to that spiritual master. Now we talk about Shiksha Guru. Out of many such competent Shravan Gurus, one who gives instruction in bhajan suitable to the bhava of the sadhaka is called a Shiksha Guru. There may be many Shiksha Gurus also. It's advantageous to have one Shiksha Guru. In particular, the Shiksha Guru are usually one and the same person. So oftentimes, whoever you're hearing from, you're hearing from some Guru, he's Shravan Guru. And later, he actually starts to function as your Shiksha Guru. He gives you specific instructions of what to do and what not to do. Or the other one is just, generally speaking, all kinds of philosophy, Shravan Guru, you're hearing. So that's Shravan Guru, Shiksha Guru, now Diksha Guru. The Guru who gives mantra for worship according to rules and regulations of scripture is called Diksha Guru, or Mantra Guru. Diksha Guru should be well conversant with the conclusions in the Vedas. He should be adept in expounding those conclusions. He knows the Vedas. He's expert in explaining them. He had direct experience and realized Krishna. And he's completely detached from material sense objects. If he's lacking, if he doesn't have these characteristics, then the faith of the disciple will waver. So he may see the Guru, he speaks very nicely. He's extremely learned, and he's answering all your questions. But you see that he's just eating all the time, snacking and eating, and doesn't seem to be very much controlling his senses. He doesn't eat many times a day. He's not regulated. He eats very lavishly and luxurious foods. He seems to be very attached to eating, which is a normal person in the same way. Because a guru who's actually fixed in Brahman or fixed in spiritual realization, he eats very little because he's not concerned with this world very much. He takes a little chapati, sabji, dal, that's it. He's not mad after gratifying his tongue with varieties of sweets and fried foods and tasty items. You don't see him sitting down for big meals. He eats very simply. He eats to live. He doesn't live to eat. There's only one Diksha Guru, and the Shiksha Guru should be harmonious or in conformity with the Diksha Guru. Otherwise, impediments may arise in the practice of sadhana. There is no direction that permits one to renounce a sadguru. However, a guru who has become inimical to Vaishnavas, Shastras, and Bhakti, who is attached to sense enjoyment, and who lacks discrimination as to what is duty and what is not duty, who is foolish and is following a path other than Shuddha Bhakti, he should be given up. Then take Diksha again from a Vaishnava guru in accordance with the rules and regulations. Then he quotes the verse of Bhakti Vilas. In other words, one who accepts a mantra from a non-Vaishnava guru goes to hell. Therefore, one should again receive Diksha mantra from a Vaishnava guru in accordance with the rules and regulations. If someone has a bad guru, then he can leave that guru and take Diksha again from a proper guru. Bad guru means one who's always, he's inimical to other Vaishnavas, he hates them. He's also, he doesn't agree with the Shastras, he's inimical to the path of bhakti. And then he becomes absorbed in sense gratification. He doesn't know what his duty is, and he's acting foolishly. He can be rejected. That's the first thing, surrender to guru. Now the second limb of devotion is accepting initiation from the spiritual master and receiving instructions from him, which we've been hearing about. It's called Sri Krishna Diksha Adi Shikshanam. Rupa Goswami again quotes Sri Prabhuda. A disciple has to accept the spiritual master not only as one spiritual master, but also as a representative of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. After rejecting material life and taking shelter of a spiritual master, one must accept him with full faith. Diksha is the spiritual master's formal acceptance of a disciple's commitment and faith. Without this commitment, the disciple cannot possess the unyielding faith required to properly assimilate the guru's spiritual instructions. Srila Prabhupada explains, one should learn Srimad Bhagavatam seriously with all respect and veneration for the spiritual master. So now this is talking about Diksha and Shiksha. So we find a guru who has all good qualities, inspires us and increases our faith and attachment to Krishna, and he behaves very nicely and very purely, and he's convinced of the Shastra and he realized them. And then we take Shiksha, we take instruction from him. Then eventually we receive mantra Diksha from him also. So this word Diksha is defined in Hari Bhakti Vilas. Divyam jnanam yato dadyat kuryat papasya sankshayam. Tasmad dikshati sa prokta neshikais taptakovide. 2.9 Hari Bhakti Vilas. That religious undertaking which bestows divya jnana, or transcendental knowledge, and destroys pap, sin, papa bij, the seed of sin, and avidya, ignorance to the root, is called diksha, by learned authorities in the absolute truth. By bestowing the Krishna mantra, Sri Gurudev dispels the jiva's aversion toward the Lord. Bhagavad Vimukata, and directs his attention toward the performance of Bhagavad Bhajan. The Guru gives Sambandha Gyan concerning Bhagavad Tattva, Jiva Tattva, Maya Tattva, and awakens the dormant inclination of the Jiva to serve the Lord. Bhakti Sandarbha Jiva Goswami says, Divya Gyan, which means spiritual knowledge, is transcendental knowledge contained within a mantra which reveals the form and identity of the Supreme Lord, as well as the knowledge of the sadhaka jiva's particular relationship with the Lord. The relationship between Bhagavan and the jiva is that of servant and served. Bhagavan is the served, Sevya is in terms here. The Sevak Bhagavan and the Sevya Bhagavan. The Sevya means who is served. So that's Bhagavan Sri Krishna. And the Sevaka or Sevak is the Jiva. He's a servant. That is only a general relationship. In advanced stage of devotion, this same relationship manifests in one particular form out of the various moods of ecstasy. Dasya Sakya Vatsalya. Sri Gurudev, knowing the Swarupa Gata Bhav, he gives nourishment to that particular mood within his heart in order to bring it clearly to view. So the devotee, he's taking diksha, he's serving his guru, chanting mantras. So after some time, he becomes advanced in spiritual consciousness and he begins to have some revelation of his own eternal form. This is what's being told. And then, in cooperation with the guru, who understands this internal disposition, then he gives nourishment to that mood within his heart in order to bring it clearly into view. Now, it may be some rough idea of his swarup. And he reveals his mind, and then the guru confirms that and clarifies that. So guru is always needed. This endeavor.